You're listening to Talk Radio 1230 KJFK.
Talk Radio 1230 KJFK now presents Happy Talk, hosted by Michelle Happy. Happy Talk is heard the last Sunday of every month from 9 to 10 a.m.
It's pretty fascinating to hear about other people's stuff. I mean, it's fascinating to me. And, you know, I think most people are pretty interested in you know, sort of the disorders that we live with that make us the walking wounded. It's really easy with the way things are going now to turn to substances to try to soothe our angst. If we have any emotional disorders, those tend to blossom under stress. So now is a really good time to be hearing about this stuff. People are fascinating, and the human spirit is amazing.
Michelle is licensed in the state of Nevada as an addictions therapist, and she'll talk with you about just about anything. Give her a call at 825-7529. Now, here's your host, Michelle Happy.
Good morning, and welcome to Happy Talk. It's kind of funny hearing my voice when I had really bad allergies, which I also have today. So if you have allergies, it means you're allergic to juniper and cedar, because that's what's blooming right now.
Ooh.
I have with me today my buddy Ed Lynn. He's a psychiatrist, and he's here to take your questions. So I'm really hoping that you all will call in. I also have with me my sidekick, Jessica.
That's me.
Levity. She's here. Ed, welcome.
Ah, good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. You know, I was making a list of things we could talk about. We could go on for hours and hours, but I'm really hoping to get some phone calls from people. So give a call in. The number is 825-7529. If you're too shy to call in and you do have a question, you can email me at mhappy.com, and you just click the email me button on the front of my website. It works for everyone except for Internet Explorer. So I've got my iPhone in my hand, and it'll buzz me.
How do you spell happy?
In. It's H-A-P-P-E. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, she's saving my tush this morning.
I'm the Robin to your Batman.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And we also have Michelle Rivera doing production. I hope she chimes in.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to have you here. So Ed, you are a psychiatrist, and I just want to briefly delineate the difference between psychiatrist, psychologist, and therapist, which is what I do, the lowly therapist. You're the medical doctor on high.
Well, that would help me, so let's delineate.
I'll get off the high horse and tell you a little bit about it. First, let me explain what my training was. I went to medical school for 4 years, and after that started my training in internal medicine until I saw the light and switched to psychiatry, which was a three-year residency program. So a psychiatrist is a physician who specializes in the diagnosis and treatments of mental disorders, disorders of thoughts, feelings, and behavior. Psychologist training, at least in the state of Nevada, one has to have a PhD or a doctorate in clinical psychology to be called a clinical psychologist. Their training after college usually involves a 3 to 5 year program to get their doctorate, which includes a lot of training in evaluations and non-medical treatments of these mental disorders. They also have to write a dissertation, a research project typically, which is probably the hardest part for many of my colleagues who've gotten their PhDs. And say they evaluate and they do treat a lot of the mental disorders that psychiatrists do without using drugs. So they use non-medical or non-somatic therapies. They're also quite astute in psychological evaluations, the testing. Although I was exposed to some of that in my training, nowhere near as much as clinical psychologists. So they do the psychological evaluations, brain functioning evaluations, and the like. There are other therapists, alcohol and drug treatment counselors.
Like me.
And myself. I'm also an ordained alcohol and drug treatment counselor who treat other specific disorders. There are also social workers and other psychologists without the PhD at the master's level who also do talking kinds of therapies. And it turns out in our country, most of the therapies that are done by clergy. Spiritual counseling, pastoral counseling probably takes care of more people than all the others put together. So there are a number of us out there who do provide mental health care for the population.
And the way Ed and I have worked together is, you know, in my world, I have a scope of practice, and it's supposed to be addiction and then sort of people who are affected by addiction. And I'm not qualified really to diagnose, but I know a lot about the different disorders so that when I suspect that somebody has something that needs to be addressed with medicine, particularly, or other treatments, then I refer those people over to Ed, who I can't do that with anymore because he's retired, and it really makes me mad. But I have other psychiatrists that I do refer to. And the best way to do that is to work as a team. So when Ed and I were working together, we would have lunch every week and we would gossip about our clients to make sure that we were giving them the best care. Of course, we're still having lunch every week, which is a treat.
And now we talk about our own problems.
Right. Retired life.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Yes. I highly recommend it.
Mm. So again, if you want to call in, the number's 825-7529, or you can email me through my website, mhappy.com. Also, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Google+. It goes on and on. And I, on my Facebook page, I do a lot of little Buddhist teachings. So you might want to friend me there to get those if you're interested in those. So, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind, what I'm noticing in my practice more and more is opiate addiction. People who sometimes they start out with pain and they get on opiates and then develop a problem with the opiates. Mm. And most of us probably know people who are getting, sometimes, you know, you get a few doctors and you do a little juggling with your doctors to get prescriptions. So it just.
Yeah, I was just thinking, so in your experience, are most of these people completely aware of what they're doing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, there's a lot of doc shopping that goes on. And then you can also buy them on the street. So what's your experience been with that?
Well, it's interesting. Early on in my training, the most common addiction to opiates was heroin addiction, mm-hmm. using street drugs pretty much. And although heroin has had a resurgence of late, most of the opiate addiction that I was encountering in later years were prescription drugs, either legitimately through physicians or doctor shopping or over the internet. You know, there are some rather unethical people who over the internet, you can get some alleged physician who will ask three questions, you know, what's your name, age, and how tall are you? And he okays the shipment of narcotics, typically some of the ones that are prescribed for pain management. And so OxyContin is a big one right now, and it goes for quite a lot of money in the street. Mm-hmm. So that's a major problem in our culture right now, especially among young people.
You know, I heard a really interesting show on NPR years ago that talked about opiate addiction. And this doctor was saying if you are treating only the pain, that you don't have as much difficulty with addiction. If you like the drug and you use it to treat your emotional angst, that's when you get hooked.
Agree. Yeah.
What kind of resources are in place in hospitals that are prescribing this stuff to make sure that this doesn't happen?
Well, I think the resource has to do with the prescribing physician initially. If someone comes into hospital for a surgery, say, and has significant pain, I think the issue is to take care of the pain and not have it on a PRN or as-needed basis where people have to ask for it and they're clock watching. You know, kind of thing, but rather make sure the person is pain-free, and as soon as that initial period of treatment is over, to very smoothly withdraw the person from the medication so that they're essentially drug-free in a reasonable amount of time. it doesn't take more than a couple of weeks of heavy narcotic treatment to become medically dependent upon the drug, and that if you stopped abruptly, you would develop significant withdrawal symptoms, which will lead to further use of the drug. And fortunately, in the state of Nevada, with our pharmacy board, I can, with the click on my computer, putting in some information about a patient of mine, find out in the recent past how much medication that person got from any pharmacy in the whole state of Nevada. And sometimes just one look can tell me that this person's in trouble, that the person is doctor shopping, using several pharmacies, having more than a couple of physicians prescribing the same drug. And it's a no-brainer to figure out that this person is in trouble and needs some immediate intervention.
Yeah, so if you're doctor shopping, just know you can get popped for that. So, I have a client. This is a very difficult thing that she's going through. She's definitely addicted to the opiates. And when she describes her response to the opiates, she talks about getting high, feeling very energetic. When I take an opiate, I go to sleep. I get really loaded and sleepy, but she feels very energized and high, which indicates there's some physiological difference going on. But we're titrating down now, which means, as you said, smoothly withdrawing from the drug. But she still has valid nerve pain, very, very debilitating nerve pain. And how would you deal with a person like that who wants to get off opiates but still has pain that needs to be dealt with?
Well, I don't know how thoroughly she's been evaluated, but there are non-opiate drugs that are used for nerve pain, drugs like
Neurontin. Exactly. She's on Neurontin.
And sometimes the drug has to be titrated up fairly highly to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing are there are some psychological treatments in addition to help people deal with pain. In fact, in my own practice, I didn't allow my patients to use the word pain. They had to describe it some other way. I thought that pain, just using the word pain, was too much of a trigger for some of these people, and they got so focused on the pain that they weren't dealing with other issues that were making them more susceptible to this response, to whatever was triggering it.
You did that to get them to deal with the more psychological issues?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So the pain is real, but you're challenging them to dig a little deeper.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The issue about real, many patients would come to me after seeing another clinician saying, they told me it's all in my head.
And everything is in our head,
exactly.
Folks.
Everything is everything we experience, see, do, feel, say, is basically an electrical chemical event in the brain. So indeed, everything is in our head.
I see we have a call. We have a call on line one, and I didn't get your name, caller, but what's your question? Are you there?
There's a lot of activity out there with borderline personality disorder. It seems to be showing up more and more. I think at this point, everyone probably knows someone like this.
Right. And you know what else is interesting about that? I think when any of us are under extreme amounts of stress, and we're gonna define borderline for you here in a second, but anyone can show borderline symptoms if their stress levels are high enough. So, Ed, you wanna tackle borderline?
Yeah, one is some people say that the borderline personality is the bread and butter of psychotherapists.
Right.
That these often are the patients who come to see us needing help. They don't come in for their borderline personalities typically. They come in for feeling depressed or anxious or having some relationship problems.
Usually having to do with anger and rage.
Yeah, there's a sense of discontrol among people who are diagnosed with borderline disorder. And anger is one, the inability to deal with anger in an appropriate fashion. There's nothing wrong with feeling angry, and we all will experience feeling angry. It's what we do with it, how we express it, how we stuff it or act it out. The other interesting issue about people with borderline personalities is they're here and now people typically. They don't tend to learn much from their past. They don't think much about consequences in the future. They may be more fun to take to a party or to have as a playmate, but in relationship issues, it's very, very difficult.
It's difficult in relationship because of a thing that goes on called switching. And what can happen is the borderline, which I don't like that term, by the way. They should. It really is a post-traumatic, like a complex post-traumatic stress issue. In order to have borderline, you need to have some childhood trauma of some kind and also a certain kind of a nervous system that tends to be more sensitive. And so when you're living with a borderline, oftentimes something will happen. They will get triggered and you're off on a roller coaster of a lot of pain, emotional pain.
Did the caller, are you still there?
Yes, sir.
Did you have a specific question about borderline personality disorder?
All the evidence points to that there is not a successful treatment yet, that the success rate for the diagnosis is essentially zero. I was wondering if the issue of comorbidity, you were talking about addiction or learning disabilities, if the borderline type individual attaches themselves to another problem and then magnifies that to the point that they can get help from people without approaching the real issue, which is the borderline.
Yes, and you know,
it was a misdirection. Is there any approach that can be taken here?
Well, I can speak to that. I think one of the most successful approaches, and I work with borderline. In fact, I love working with borderlines because oftentimes there's sort of a need for reparenting, which I enjoy doing. Is mindfulness techniques. And most of y'all know that I'm Buddhist, and there's a type of therapy called dialectical behavior therapy that was developed by Marsha Linehan, and she looked into mindfulness and Buddhist meditation. And so when I'm working with the borderline, I ask them, well, first what we do is we talk about that they have this borderline. I usually go through the 9 symptoms and they go, yep, that's me. And then I say, okay, well, you need to have a relationship with yourself in that way. And that when you get triggered, to be able to mindfully say, okay, I'm triggered into my borderline stuff is what I call it. So, I've worked with a lot of borderlines who've gotten significantly better. And also, those other symptoms that you were mentioning, the comorbidities, those need to be addressed and treated as well. So, Ed, did you have?
Yeah, I think the caller is quite correct. Many persons who are designated as borderline have alcohol and or drug problems. And also
food and
a lot
cutting.
Of difficulties in the sexual domain as well.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my patients with borderline personalities were female. And I'd say the vast majority of them had experienced physical and or sexual abuse as children.
Right.
So dealing with those issues would be important as well. But the caller is correct. Unless you deal with the alcohol and or drug addictions first, you can't get beyond that.
And we'll continue with this after we take a break. I'm getting so absorbed, I'm forgetting to do that. Caller, thanks so much.
Certainly.
They're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to
So we are back, and we're having a really lively discussion during the break about this whole borderline personality issue. And Jessica, you had some really good observations.
Well, I think to the average layman who doesn't have any experience in psychiatry or any training in counseling, this person, borderline personality disorder, usually shows up in the normal person's life as the crazy friend who always has something wrong going on. And they're, I mean, it might seem like a drama queen on one level, but there's something so much more than that. And what I've noticed with the person who used to be in my life is they would cause so much drama and to get everybody to look in one direction. And it was like a smoke and mirrors. And while everybody was focused on one problem they've created, they'd be somewhere else creating a whole nother problem. And then the first person to stop, pull out of that basically codependent game and say, hey, I think you need help. Well, then all of a sudden things would get really ugly because they're crying out for help, but they don't actually, they're not ready to hear it yet.
And, you know, on the issue of anger. Anger is a secondary emotion. And what happens oftentimes when you're really triggered is all of your emotions get funneled into that one emotion of just like bursting anger. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you see a lot. And in working with borderlines, you have to teach them to express and identify all those different emotions. So, Ed, did you want to?
Yeah, I think, you know, fear often is the underlying emotion in many of us when we get angry. And I'm thinking of the extreme form of borderline person. If you think about the Glenn Close movie, Fatal Attraction, I mean, that is the extreme version of someone who has a borderline diagnosis.
Yes.
It's a great movie.
Can we hear about the 9 symptoms? Because I'm even wondering, I mean, I very much have a former me that I have grown out of and learned from. And I'm wondering how much of that me had some form of borderline.
Well, let's see. Well, you help me with this because I have to do this out of my memory. So one of the symptoms is mood swings.
Check.
And they usually last no more than a couple days, and they can be much less frequent than that. Having issues with substance, eating and food issues, that's 2. 3 is having difficulty with sexual identity. You know, am I gay? Am I straight? Am I bi? What am I? What am I? Who am I? Also having having love-hate relationships with people. So 1 minute they are idolized, they are the best in the world, and the next minute they are hated by you. So there's this shift happens. Ed, you were mentioning that sometimes it can get so severe that you can go into a kind of psychosis.
You can have a brief reactive psychosis where there's a break with reality and either have delusions, beliefs not based in fact, unshakable by reason, or actual hallucinations, visual or auditory.
Wow. How many of us are starting to go, oh, my God, I know somebody.
Right.
Can't win an argument. There's just absolutely no, when they're in that psychosis, they're not even speaking your language anymore.
Yes. Thanks, Michelle. She brought up all the symptoms. That's so sweet. So nice to have such a great producer.
I know. She's amazing.
There is all that back and forth. I hate you. Don't leave me. Come here. Go away. Cutting, self-abusive behaviors is another symptom. And so if you or anyone you know feels the need to cut, then you probably need to look and see if you have some of those other symptoms as well. Usually that is the case. And I work with a number of people who are dealing with their cutting issues. Again, it's having a relationship with your need to do that. So Ed, did you have something else? What am I missing?
Let me mention fear of being alone.
Intolerance of being alone. So borderlines tend to be very clingy.
And jump
and
from relationships.
And when you're there with them, they try to push you away. Because, you know, it's like a volcano of emotions going on all at once. And I can see that someone is on the phone. Are we ready for them, Michelle? Okay. Hello. You're on Happy Talk. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about depression.
Sure.
Is this Michelle?
This is.
Oh, hi. This is Michael.
Hi, Michael. How are you? Hey,
I'm okay.
Michael, tell us where you're calling from.
I'm calling from Pasadena.
Pasadena, California. You know, this show is streamed online now, so anyone who is out of the Reno area can get the show. So, yes, Michael, your question. I also had a text with a similar question, so let's deal with
it. Oh, you did?
Yeah, so go ahead. What's your question?
Well, as you may recall, I'm grieving the loss of my partner.
Yes.
And, you know, I just wanted to get some idea about, excuse me, my throat, about, you know, kind of the normal grief process, because, you know, there's such a fine balance between allowing myself to grieve and not falling in the hole of depression. So I don't know if the doctor can speak to that or if you want to speak to that. But
sure, that's a great question.
Know, I'm wrestling with that, and I just would appreciate any comments you might
have
about that.
Sure, thanks for calling.
Sure.
Well, it's a whole spectrum of grieving, and we've all dealt with loss. Loss of a job, loss of a loved one, loss of self-esteem, loss of a limb. So loss is quite common in our, you know, world of experience. Grieving is a very natural phenomenon. And unfortunately, in some ways, the pharmaceutical industry is trying to label grief as a disease now so that more antidepressants can be prescribed for it. I think masking grief is not the way to go. I think grief needs to be dealt with by talking it out, by getting oneself back in a routine, by having a call in your markers of your friends, bringing friends in, social networking, getting support. And most of us are willing to give support to others who are in trouble and are quite reluctant to ask for it. So being able to ask for help, being able to talk it out.
Cry it out.
Depending on what the loss is, sometimes there are groups who can get together and support one another, mm-hmm. and there's vicarious learning when one does it in a group setting where you learn from how others are coping and dealing with their grieving. Parents, for example, who have lost children, there are support groups for them. Mm-hmm. I think losing a lover, if there is some church affiliation, there are groups sometimes within a church system that helps people grieve the loss of a partner or a lover. So there are lots of things that one can do. I think if it's done early enough, it's less likely for that grieving to develop into what's called pathological grieving, where the person does become clinically depressed. It's beyond, you know, the weeks or a few months. Not being able to go back to work, not being able to deal with anybody, not answering the phone, not dealing with personal hygiene, things of that nature.
Right.
One book that I really liked when I was in practice, when someone loses a loved one, is a book entitled I'm Grieving as Fast as I Can.
That's great.
And what's nice about it is that there's no cookbook timetable. We each take different ways in losing a loved one. I remember as a young boy, there was a woman who lived across the street, all dressed in black. And I asked a friend of mine, why is Mrs. Smith all dressed in black? I thought maybe she was part of some nun order or something like that. And this friend of mine said, oh, she lost her husband. And I said, wow, when did that happen? 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And some people used to say that grieving should take no more than a year when you're grieving the loss of a loved one. Well, it can go on for a long time. It's the extent to which it goes on and how disabling it might be in our life in terms of work, education, social interaction.
So I'd like to add just a couple of little Buddhist concepts in there, because we do all grieve differently and we do all have different time periods. But it is important to remember impermanence, you know, that it will pass. And Michael, I know you're right in the middle of it. So you can soothe yourself by knowing that as time goes on, it will change, it will get different, and it will get better. And I also think we judge ourselves when we grieve. Like if we're crying or feeling the pain, we say, I'm really doing badly. I think you're doing well when you're actually grieving, and you know, unless it's a 30-year thing and it's a pathological
right.
thing. But we're in this culture, we're kind of anti-showing emotion, and That's why it's important to have a good friend to do that with. And I remember a couple times when Big Eddie over here did that for me, losing numerous relationships and also pets, that he just was like a person for me to lean against when I was hurting. So
it sounds like you guys are saying, both of you are saying, that the healing takes place within the grieving and not by ignoring it
exactly.
or resisting it.
Beautifully, beautifully put.
Yeah, I've been really open with my grief, and I, you know, it's embarrassing in a sense. I'm in public, and I just say a word, and all of a sudden I'm, you know, crying.
Right.
And I can't control it. The lump comes up. Yeah, I can hear it in my voice now. The lump
I
just
can
comes
too.
Up.
Yes.
And it's, you know.
How long has it been for you, Michael?
He passed away on November 1st. Mm.
So that's very, very recent. And, you know, I think I'm into what I call the fully felt feeling. So when you feel those feelings come up in a proper environment, I mean, in the middle of 7-Eleven, it's probably not a great idea. But to call over a friend and have a really good boo-hoo. And just really soak a towel, you know, get a towel and just get it wet. And the more you do that fully felt without limitation or judgment, the more you're going to heal through the pain of it. And then the other Buddhist concept that I was thinking of is suffering, that suffering's a part of the deal in this life. And we're all going to experience suffering. There's no way to avoid it. Of course, some of us can bring it on by doing silly things. But suffering, we just have to kind of make peace with the fact that there will be times of suffering. And then remembering impermanence. And this segment is impermanent. We need to take a break, I just realized.
Okay. So, and Michael, before you go, I want to throw something in. This is the other Michelle, and okay. I lost a sibling 12 years ago, and we were 1 year apart in age, so it was a really difficult blow. And I'll tell you that putting off my grief to hold my parents up for a year delayed my ability to heal. And I know that it took me longer to get well again after surviving that loss because I waited. And I think that it's beautiful that you can even think about this right away so soon. The earlier you deal with it, the more time you have to get past it. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Okay.
Let's
Bye-bye.
Take that break.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
That is perfect bumper music segue to what we're talking about, isn't it? I picked that bumper music.
I can tell because you're so proud of it. She's just got this big grin on her face, like, listen to the music coming back in. It's perfect.
So we were talking about grieving and depression, and I want to read, Ed, for you, one of our questions, which is related, but it kind of encapsulates everything. Why are so many Americans on antidepressants, and what causes depression? Take your pick.
Okay. Let me finish with the grieving.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are some losses over which we never get completely.
Right.
Especially loss
Children.
Of a child, for example. And it's not getting over the loss, it's getting through it. And one thing to remember, and Michael, if you're still listening, I'm so sorry for your loss, in that there may be things down the road, even when you're feeling better, all of a sudden something happens, maybe the anniversary of the person's birthday or your wedding anniversary or Christmas or special events or a special place that will stir up these feelings. And remember, tissues don't leave home without them. And you may feel, oh, my God, I'm not through this yet. Well, you're not back to square one. It just has stirred it up, and it may stir it up for some time to come, and that's okay. Regarding depression, it's such a ubiquitous phenomenon. Let me address, you know, almost all illnesses generally and then focus in on depression, that there are so many components. There are genetic components. What are we endowed with? In terms of the disease itself or the propensity, the vulnerability to developing such an illness. What happened during pregnancy, the gestational influences? Was mom on hormones? Was she smoking, drinking, drugging during that time? environmental influences, how we were raised, what were the traumas in our life, how were we educated or not, relationship issues, work history, and also situational issues, what's going on now in our lives. Now, I think too many people are medicated needlessly for their depression, and many people who do need medication for depression should probably be in counseling or psychotherapy as well, because it seems to work a lot better. There are so many external causes of depression. Alcohol and drug abuse, for example. So many people who are abusing are depressed. One untapped issue that's becoming more in the field of knowing is sleep disorders. People with obstructive sleep apnea are chronically depressed and don't know they have the sleep disorder, because they don't know they snore and gasp during their sleep. Their bed partners might, but they don't know. There are metabolic disorders that can cause depression, thyroid disorders, adrenal problems. Certain cancers can cause depression. Brain disorders can cause depression. So all these things need to be ruled out when one is evaluating a person who comes in complaining of depression before an antidepressant is even started. We might be missing something. Certainly there are those who do respond well to antidepressants, typically people with major depressive disorders, but not everybody with a major depression responds appropriately to these mm-hmm. medications, and they're not without some side effects. Mm-hmm. So we need to handle those judiciously as well. So I think we're probably over-medicating people, because we're probably under-diagnosing the causes of the depression for mm. these people. When it's a situational issue, certainly if the depression is really recent, it's not something one should jump to the prescription pad immediately to assess what the issues are, what the losses are, and have the person deal with those rather than mask them, as we've spoken about before, masking this depression with a drug instead of dealing with the issues underlying.
So don't treat the symptom.
Well, we have to treat the disorder, and it may involve depression may be just a symptom of other things.
Like chronic fatigue. You know, people who have chronic fatigue or Lyme disease, or, I mean, there's any number of illnesses that make you very, very tired, which is one of the symptoms of depression. So
any chronic illness, chronic
pain,
diabetes, heart disease can lead to depression. And some of these folks might benefit from antidepressants, but they also need to be treated for their chronic underlying illness.
Yes, and studies have found that therapy and medication is much more effective than medication alone, and sometimes therapy alone, depending on what the issue is. So,
and one other issue, too, as we forget, is that psychotherapy or talking therapy is not without some side effects either. There are a number. There was one study that suggested about 7% of people just in talking therapies are made worse by the talking therapy than when they came in. So there's nothing we do in the human interaction that is totally okay. We have to be mindful of
everything,
all sorts of consequences.
And there's the placebo effect, too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
If there are any callers or listeners out there who have been through depression and have come out the other side, I would love to hear
from somebody. So call in. The number is 825-7529. And I think we're coming up on a break here. So why don't we take that break? Give us a call. Let us know your success story with depression. Hey, welcome back. You know, we have two callers. I want to deal with the depression call first. This is about getting better from chemical depression. Hi, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
So can Dr. Lynn, or I should say Ed, help you? Or me?
Well, you know, I'm calling about about the question of how people got better from their depression.
Awesome.
Great.
Yes, and I just wanted to point out that sometimes I think it's really hard to figure out how much your depression is linked to your chemical, because I was diagnosed with chemical depression, and, you know, watched my mom struggle with it. I've been here all my life with this chemical depression, but I also knew I was very unhappy in my marriage. Mm. But I'd been married for more than 30 years, and we had kids kind of late. So then I was dealing with breaking up the family also when my boys were teenagers. And it was incredibly hard, and it wasn't until the marriage just really ground down to a halt that we both gave up. And in doing so, 3 years later, I am so much more happy.
Wow.
But those 3 years were really difficult. You know, you think, I'm so unhappy, I just want out, I just want to move on, but it's not that easy when you value family so much.
Right.
I lost my unit family, my husband and my boys, as far as us being a unit together, a family, but I also lost 30 years of being part of my ex-husband's family, which, you know, was a very large family, and I cherished that relationship also, and I feel like I've lost a lot, but I've also gained my independence and my happiness, and I know my life will get better
and what,
now.
What you're saying is you have sort of a balance sheet in your head where you can weigh out the loss with the gains. And I also heard you talk about having guilt, and guilt and depression can be very linked up together. So
right.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely codependent, you know, and I mm-hmm. always, gosh, I'm going to sound like I think the world of myself, but I'm always thinking about others, you know, before myself, mm-hmm. and I did that for so many years. Plus, I had the also after my son was born, I had seasonal depressive disorder where, you know, living in the mountains in the gray was just overwhelming, too. So mm-hmm. I had depression coming from three different directions, and it's really hard to figure out. My point is, it's really hard to figure out what, you know, exactly where it's coming from, to kind of figure out what you need to do in order to make your life happier. And it's just so hard to make those big changes, I think.
Right. And that's where therapy comes in sometimes, to help get a flow chart going, so you can really look at all those different issues. What having someone who's a little bit more objective than you mm-hmm. are when you're inside of this maelstrom of all these things going on at once.
Yes. One more point I'd like to make is, I went to a therapist and he said, if you were to imagine yourself happy, where would you be? What would your situation be? And I knew immediately. I could tell him because I fantasized about it.
Good question. Are you there?
Excuse me?
Are you there?
Oh, I am. I am. I'm absolutely there. But he didn't go so far to say, there's your answer.
Mm.
There's your answer as far as your marriage. Because
right.
that was what I was there. And my husband definitely wasn't in my fantasy of happiness.
So was it one day you woke up after you had made this decision and you realized you were better, or was it still very much a process after you left your marriage?
Oh, it's been a long process. The night that we talked about separating, decided it was time to separate, I sat up for 4 or 5 hours and just wrote and wrote and wrote. And I go back to those papers now to remind myself of exactly where I was. Believe it or not, you can kind of forget that.
Mm-hmm.
And just how incredibly happy I was to be finally taking that step.
Wow, thank you so
Great
much for
call.
Calling.
Yeah, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
We have another caller, and this is Lynn and Ryan calling to say hi from Michigan. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, how are
this
you?
This is Lynn, and I'm overwhelmed. I'm going to cry because I feel like my grandson Ryan and I are talking to our family.
Yes,
because
hi, Lynn, Ryan,
we know. Oh, Ed, how are you?
Oh,
it's so
I'm
good
great.
To hear your voice.
It's good to hear you.
And we are blessed to have been clients to both of these wonderful professionals.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just like talking to family, and of which I don't have much left anymore, but I made the decision that we would move to a colder climate and to pursue my sled dog adventures. And the whole idea of leaving on the it was very hard to leave California in many ways, so I really relate to the previous caller. I didn't know how many ties I had to the people there, but I wanted you guys to know that we are actually the hardest part is keeping the wood going. and I am so cheap that I don't like to pay those propane bills.
But you're better. In Michigan. Sometimes a geographic move can be a very good thing. It isn't always the geographic cure. So, and I'm starting to hear the music, Lynn. I want to thank you so much for calling in.
I want to wish you the best and that I will be calling you, Michelle, because I have a couple of issues.
Okay, great.
But thank you for having us on.
Sure thing.
And you're a deep part in both of you. And in my heart, you taught me it's okay to hurt.
That's right.
That's what I learned.
It is. So, Jessica,
okay.
Thanks so much for calling, Lynn.
Bye-bye.
Love you. Bye. Jessica, you want to
The voiceover at the very beginning of the intro of your show talks about how interesting it is to look at other people's problems. And I thought this is so existential because it's so much easier to see other people's problems than your problems. And as I'm looking back in the last few years of my life, I definitely think I showed symptoms of borderline personality disorder. And what brought me through it was my friends beginning to point out to me the issues that I had. Mm-hmm. And at first it was extremely hard to hear, but your friends are an amazing resource for
yes.
the things that you're doing that are not serving you.
And you're describing mindfulness. You achieved,
yes.
You were able to hear what they were saying and have enough objectivity to stand just a touch outside yourself
yeah.
and say, this has
to
got
Happy
to change.
Talk. Heard the last Sunday of every month from 9 to 10 a.m. with your host, Michelle Happy. Find Michelle online at mhappy.com. Happy is spelled H-A-P-P-E. Join us again the last Sunday of every month at 9 a.m. Diane Underwood and Reverse Aging will be back next Sunday at 9 here on Talk Radio 1230 KJFK Reno, a service of Americom Broadcasting.